The other night, in the questions, there was a question asking about the stories of why the other members of the community had come to the monastery, had committed to living a monastic life. And so I thought this morning I could maybe ask the others to give a small recap or a bit of a background. It's probably helpful to people. It's easy to sort of think of the say the monastic as being somehow special or something, and that's I think we share the same aspirations, same concerns, same difficulties, and have ended up in my own case in a monastery for over 40 years, so it just seemed to be the thing that made the most sense. Still does. But I'll maybe begin with Debbie and then just move the mic up along the line.
I kind of mentioned a few things yesterday. I think I mentioned that I had gone through a year of student teaching and had anxiety attacks every morning, and decided I couldn't do that. It would kill me. And then I wasn't sure what else to do. And so I thought I was just going, saving up money. I moved out of an apartment so I could save up more money and just kind of lived out of my car and house sat so that I could join in a photography workshop in Nepal that my friend was leading. And I thought that's what I was going for until my friend said, often people go to that part of the world on some kind of spiritual search. And it did stop my mind for a moment. And I was like, oh no, that's not what I'm doing. But in the end, it is what I was doing, searching for something and kind of feeling like I didn't know what my next step was. And so having been in Thailand a little bit, then I went to Nepal, and then I went overland into Tibet. And it was just the experience of to me it was very tangible, the devotion in the Tibetan people. And it touched something very deeply in me, and I wanted that. I wanted to feel that. But I didn't know what was going to get me there, so was in a cafe back in Kathmandu and talking to someone, and I just mentioned that I'd been around Buddhists in Thailand, and I'd been around the Tibetan Buddhists, and something really struck me with them, but I didn't really understand anything. I knew nothing of Buddhism, meditation. And she suggested taking a retreat, and so I thought, okay. I wanted to take it with the Tibetans because I was so moved by that devotional aspect, but I already had my ticket to Thailand. And so I went on to Thailand. Just some interesting things at the airport, I met a woman I'd met her in a Tibetan refugee camp, and she was a Westerner, and she was there to study with a Rinpoche there. And when I told her that I was going to take a meditation retreat, she got very enthusiastic, and she took a cord that her Rinpoche had blessed, and she said, and to me it meant nothing. She tied this cord around my neck, and she said, may you find the Dharma. And I was like, well, that's nice. It's a nice little string. And then I've been very fortunate because I went back into Thailand, and that afternoon I went seeking, and this was in 86, And I went seeking a retreat. So I went down to the Travelers area, Khao San Road, and found that there was a 10-day retreat beginning down in Koh Samui, and it was the next day. So I got a ticket on the night bus and ended up taking a retreat, or, you know, getting to the place. The whole time, this thought, all right, I'm just going to take this retreat to learn about Buddhism. There's none of this conversion stuff. And then the first thing that happened is the monk that was teaching it met with us in groups of three just to ask what we were doing there. And when I told him I didn't know, I was just wanted to learn a little bit about Buddhism, he said, "You're very lucky." And I didn't understand that either. But then what happened was it was a taped talk of Ajahn Buddhadasa. And so he would speak, and then it was translated into English. And that talk completely changed my life, because all of a sudden all these questions and uncertainties kind of lined up. And I really could see in just the traveling that I'd been doing and things, I could really see that I was completely a prisoner to my mind, and I wanted to break out of that. So that's kind of what's kept me anchored in the practice through everything, but kind of synchronicity of timing and just that lost, confused, directionless heart that kind of was stumbled on a teaching that really resonated and made sense and has made all the difference in my experience of life. So that's pretty much, it's probably a common story.
All right. My time to shine. And for it now. Okay. you know, so when I do my own reflection of what brought me to the Dhamma, I think a time when being very young and wondering about death, you know, kind of getting the facts of life from my parents of, you know, you're born, you procreate, and you die. And thinking, oh, well, you know, what happens after you die? And not just kind of letting that question go, but being very young and wondering about that. And thinking, oh, you know, just one day it'll come. You know, I'll die one day and figure it out then. With that, you know, and just kind of growing up, never quite sure how my parents got together, because my mom was, or she is, a, you know, liberal feminist atheist, and my dad was Christian conservative. But somehow they brought, yeah, it's just something, you know, so there's always a spiritual void in my house, you know, there's a lot of confusion kind of around that area, you know. My mom was saying, thank you, sun god, moon god, and my dad was trying to say blessings at the dinner table, and it just didn't work out, so, you know, and there's always kind of, I always had some questions around that as a child, just not knowing. I like to say, too, like it takes a perfect storm to kind of, or what it seems like to get somebody into the robes in some way. And for me, is a lot of privilege and some dukkha involved, as I think it is with everybody. My dad had a stroke when I was 10 years old and became a really bad alcoholic. My mom divorced him, and it was a tough time growing up. Not that tough, you know. There are a lot of good things, and both my parents love me very much, and I have a good relationship with them, but it wasn't easy at a lot of times. And I think that, you know, really seeing my dad's delusion with a brain injury was something that really just showed me how, you know, so much of the mind can just put you on this loop of suffering that just didn't make any sense. You know, the things, how he would act, and, you know, just over and over and over again. And I think that's the first indication of the mind and how it works. And also just having that suffering and really looking for a way out of it, you know, and kind of moving forward with that and, you know, thinking if I, I don't know. you know, just really being disillusioned, very sad with that, and seeing my sister turn to drug abuse and, you know, the addiction in my own family and kind of dibbling and dabbling with that myself, but really having the strong example of what not to do between my dad and my sister coming out of high school, and really looking for a way out. You know, and for me and also my sister, that was, you know, pushing back the other way of, you know, exercising and really doing, really pushing the healthy aspects of things, you know, and there'd be days where, you know, it'd be 8-hour days of running and biking and yoga and working out and eating healthy. And, you know, it's just kind of a transference of energy. It wasn't wrapped up in drugs and alcohol and that sort of delusion, but a different sort of push the other way. During that, as a high school graduation gift too, I spent a month in the Talkeetna wilderness of, the King Leopold in northwestern Australia, backpacking with gnolls. And I remember how simple and peaceful I felt being out in nature with just the stuff on my back and knowing that I didn't need anything else and this, these kind of basic requisites, you know, just a little bit of food, you know, a set of clothing and a tent, and that's great. So there's a seed planted there too. I went to college, I got a degree in history, and that'll give you some world weariness for sure. You see the cycles of history, and it can be very scary sometimes to see where we're at now. It's just another cycle. I had big ambitions of being a medieval Japanese history professor, and you know, I was kind of all set to go on that track, and I was spending time up in Montana doing a 6-month residency program in primitive wilderness survival. Somebody I'd always been impressed by and really inspired by was Tom Brown Jr., a man from New Jersey, who, you know, the kind of guy that goes naked out in the woods and it's totally fine, and, you know, really brought back the native element and a deeper native spirituality, a more authentic way of living and interacting with the woods and life in general, a way of existing. And that's what I was looking for up in Montana. And I think that was kind of, you know, the first kind of gateway into a deeper sense of meditation and spirituality, but very much not associated with Buddhism. You know, it was kind of, you know, what brought a hairless, fangless, clawless species like us to the top of the food chain? And, of course, there's many answers to that, but, you know, what I was learning there from Bill McConnell was a deeper understanding of life and of nature and, you know, present time awareness of what's going on around me, how am I feeling, how am I perceiving it, how are other people perceiving it. And with that, you know, a strong dedication to a yogic practice arose out of all of that. And, you know, there was a lot of searching involved with that. And, yeah, I mean, after doing that for a while and really learning some great lessons from that is, you know, there's a time when I was just working a lot and, you know, it just became, as I hit walls with my yogic practice and my meditation, and that, you know, there needed to be a more of a refinement, and I kept looking for it. And there wasn't much Dharma up in Montana, but I would listen to Noah Levine's Against the Stream podcast, and that was really inspiring. But there was and he certainly had that fire of, you know, you got to be the good force in the world, and that's very much what my spiritual companions were like in Montana. You know, you kind of had to be a part of the gutter or in the gutter to help drag people out of it. And, you know, that left a lot of leeway for kind of bending the rules and debaucherous things. And it really just wasn't working out for me too well. So, you know, I spent some more time just working and going, you know, taking time away from society and going deeper into my yoga practice and working more on sobriety, you know, I was kind of all set to go forward with going back to grad school, and had a big trip planned. I quit my job, moved out of my apartment, and it started off with going to Abayagiri for 3 weeks. I'd been there once before to visit my sister, for 4 days, and you know, I really wasn't ready for it then. It was just kind of a stop on a road trip a few years or 4 or 5 years ago. The one thing I do remember is the day I was leaving, kind of, you know, just about to sneak out of there, and Lumpa Pasano coming out to get his meal and emptying the bowl out of his water and saying, "Armand, you know, you're welcome to come back anytime." And I thought, oh, okay. Maybe I will. And so that seed was planted for sure. And it had been something that, you know, I really wanted to spend more time with. And then I had that opportunity. And in the 3 weeks I spent there, was a lot of things just came together. A lot of things clicked that just wasn't working in lay life for me. You know, it's really hard to be a part of the world and be a spiritual practitioner, especially in Montana, where if you're trying to be sober, it's not a good way to make friends or have friends. it's what you do in the frozen north. Is it's just kind of, you got to drink to keep warm. You know, so with that, you know, I had a trip to Thailand. I was going to go on this backpacking adventure, and I came back from those 3 weeks, and I canceled that and kind of wrapped up my life a little bit and was really thinking, you know, I guess I didn't realize this, but I'd always joke with my sister, like, oh, you know, I'm just going to go become a monk. And so I went back, and I spent 3 months working the winter retreat this year, and it was another kind of culmination of whether or not to go back into the world, because I had an interview, and I got into the graduate school program to go back and be a social worker. That's something I was always really inspired by, is helping people and trying to show them a way out of, you know, their own egotism. You know, and people would always be, oh, Armand's spiritual, he does yoga and he meditates all the time. I'm like, I'm not spiritual, I'm angry. I'm angry and I'm depressed, and things aren't working quite right. But with the great guidance of the Ajahns there, and Ajahn Kuran Adamo and Ajahn Nanako and Ajahn Pasamo, saying, you know, a lot of people can go out and be social workers, but a lot of people can be monks. And, you know, at first I thought, you know, yes, I'll go out, I'll do this graduate school program, and then I'll come back and I'll be a monk if it doesn't work out. But then there's just a night when I was reading a little bit of Ajahn Mun, and he's talking about dealing with hungry ghosts. And, you know, the thought occurred to me that there's just some things in my life that I will just never be done with if I don't ordain. So with that, I stood up and I sent the graduate school coordinator an email and said I'm going to stay here at the monastery and do a year as an Anagarika and see how that goes. And yeah, here I am. And I think now, you know, there's really, over these last 5 months, the faith and dedication that has arisen will keep me in robes for the rest of my life. You know, because there's just something that, for me in particular, is, you know, I couldn't beat renunciation and non-attachment in the world. You know, there's just by virtue of living in the world, and, you know, those were the things that were really dragging me down. So, yeah, and it's been a good decision. So, thank you.
Well, I don't have a huge amount to say because probably the majority of people here have heard it many times. So I don't want to repeat myself too much, but and I get to give the reflection this afternoon too, so give airtime for others. Pretty much, you know, a normal growing up in childhood for myself, and always enjoyed just kind of being on my own for periods of time. I enjoyed being with people too, but always had a sense of comfort just hanging out with myself, playing in the sandbox, making castles, doing things like that. Going through school and the normal traumas of being a teenager, which everybody can relate to, I'm sure. I was sort of always physically on the small, wimpy side, and kind of got a hit of the craziness of the world, just minding my own business, and then all of a sudden, you know, feeling kind of intimidated by all the big bullies and things like that. So I, you know, got the usual hit that small kids get of the unfairness and the craziness of the world. Growing up like that, when I was just minding my own business, and sort of just filed that away. I remember one book that I read, and then the movie also came out. Planted a kind of a deep seed that went dormant for a long time and resurfaced later, just as a memory. But maybe some of you remember that book or that movie, Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury. It's a sort of a, I think it was, must have been in the 60s, kind of a classic movie. But the thing that it ended up being a totalitarian regime. Taking over, and a group of people, and that one of the things they were doing was destroying all the books in the world. They were the fire department, and instead of putting out fires, they created fires by burning all the books, and to try and get rid of, you know, free flowing information as a way of controlling the populace. And then there was this group of rebels who quietly moved out to the countryside and would spend their days memorizing books so that they became that book, and then would just, you know, they had a secret stash of books, and when somebody would memorize one completely, then they'd get rid of it and get rid of the evidence, and then they would just live that life out until the time came when the totalitarian regime was no longer in power and could reintroduce literature, information. And they would just spend their days out in the woods, walking back and forth, reciting. And there was something in me that, like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe when the world goes completely nuts and the crazy people take over, that's something that I'll do. But then I decided, then I kind of stuffed that one back down too. And spent the next 20 years kind of doing what everybody here knows that I did for 20 years or so, being a nurse and seeing sickness, old age, and death, and all the vicarious things that that motivates one to search deeper. Because I had some spiritual inclinations, but not in a very well-formed way. But it sort of took me that 20 years to realize that the crazy people had already taken over. And that in actuality, I was one of them too. And so I thought, I need to start walking. So yeah, that's about it, really. Came and got some ropes and started walking back on my meditation path and memorizing texts. And here I am.
So in many ways, I feel like my life began when I went to the monastery, but there was some lead up to it. Graduated high school in 1998, and that at that point, me and my friends were studying some spiritual teachings, Krishnamurti and some Tibetan Buddhism, and we would meditate together sometimes. The first Buddhist book I read was when I was a senior in high school, which was Soyal Rinpoche's The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and at that point I didn't really know it was Buddhism. I just thought it was Tibetan mysticism, or I knew the Buddha was mentioned, but didn't really know who the Buddha was, hadn't ever read the Buddha's life story, which I still had never read the Buddha's life story until I was in Anagarika. And so I graduated high school in 1998, and then I wanted to go straight into university, and I was interested in architecture, and I was also interested in doing something difficult, so I chose architectural engineering. And I went into architectural engineering in Cal Poly University in San Luis Obispo. Just whatever, 6-hour drive south of here. And about after a year and a half of being in university, then I was living with a couple of roommates. One was a fourth-year architecture student, and another was a third-year architectural engineer, and both of them were not sleeping very much. Their eyes were red a lot from staying up and doing, especially the architectural engineer student, third year, he was doing like 50-page calculations and every night, and so I saw that, and I thought, wow, do I really want to renounce everything for this? And why would I want to do this? And it kind of hit me that I'd been in school since I was 5 and never had a break. So decided to, it just hit me one day that I should, this reflection on mortality and just life. And if I only have this one life, then I want to do what I want to do. So I just decided to drop everything. And I thought, what do I really want to do? I really want to surf and play music. And so I dropped it. I dropped everything and took all the money out of my bank account, and it was just a week before finals, and I didn't go to any of my finals. I just got a one-way ticket to the island of Kauai, and had a duffel bag. I didn't know anybody there and no plan of what I was going to do when I got there. And I just got a one-way ticket, and I went there, and I just started walking down the highway with a duffel bag. And somehow things worked out. I was homeless for about maybe 3 weeks before I actually spent the last of my money convincing a guy to rent me a room for a month, because I somehow convinced him I was about to get a job. And then luckily I did. And so I got a really good job, and then slowly I just started, old habits started creeping back in, and I, this idea of, it was working out that I was, very quickly I got a surfboard and a guitar and was living my dream, but also that it was just a stepping stone, because I wasn't really it. I also had this idea of wanting to not, smoke pot and drink anymore, which was something I was really into before as well. And I was, completely sober for about 2 months, and then the old habits just started creeping back in. So that kind of hit me that desire is really difficult to go against. And so I started seeking more deeply. And I remember I went to a bookstore one day just looking for spiritual books or some sort of guidance. And I went to the Tibetan Buddhist section, and I just grabbed a book at random. It was the 100,000 Songs of Milarepa. And then I opened it to just a page in the middle of it, and it was Milarepa giving a teaching about somebody came up to him and asked, you know, what do you do for work? You're just lazy. You're a yogi, and you don't do any work. You don't do anything for the world. You just sit around, and what are you doing? And that person had said, I'm a farmer. I work all day. I sow seeds. I sow crops, and I help the populace. And so then Milarepa, of course, sings a song and says, well, I also am a farmer. And then I sow the seeds of mindfulness and water the rich ground of Bodhi and so on. So that really struck me in terms of thinking of practice in terms of farming. And so I started getting a bit more back into meditation after that. But I also had this idea of wanting to be a surf hermit and live on the beach and just work and just support myself in that way. And I was surfing some of the best waves in the world, North Shore of Kauai, and it was like a heavenly realm for a little while. So descended back into my old habits and started questioning a bit more, and I was 19 at the time. And I turned 20 when I was in Hawaii. And then I got, when I was surfing Hanalei Bay one day, I fell off my board on a wave. I was going really fast, and I dislocated my left shoulder. And that put me out of the water for a while. And I was just then working, and I just started getting more and more depressed. And in that depression, I was also reading Buddhist books, which on a certain level were adding to it, because I could see like all these qualities I wanted to cultivate, and I could also see that I didn't have them. And also I started learning about precepts, and I could see that I didn't have those, and that made me more depressed. And so at a certain point I hit rock bottom and got really depressed temporarily. And then my dad sent me a book which he had found. He had always dabbled in spirituality and poetry, but he sent me a book which he had found in a used bookstore when he was looking for a gift for his mother. He went to a used bookstore one day and found a book, Still Forest Pool by Ajahn Chah, and picked it out and liked it. So when he saw the picture of Ajahn Chah, he just burst out laughing. So he started reading the book, and he liked it so much that he kept it and didn't give it to his mother. And so he sent that book to me, and it was perfect timing. So I had never met a monk before or even seen pictures of monks, but I read that book, and I started getting an image of myself as a monk. And actually, I had more an idea of myself as a cave yogi like Milarepa, not necessarily as a monk. And I started getting fantastical images of maybe like going to Utah and living in a cave somewhere, and had no idea how that would pan out, but just thought that's what I should do. That's my next step. And so after not quite a year in Hawaii, I ended up moving back to California, moved back in with my parents, but was in a state of just wanting to meditate all the time. And friends, pretty sure I had lost it, and just wanted to stay home, meditate, read Buddhist books, and also had this strong sense that I needed to find a teacher. But first I had to try the Milarepa yogi thing, so I had my dad take me up to Big Sur, up to a private piece of land that his friend owned, and I walked 6 miles back into the wilderness where there was no trail, and just decided I was going to stay there for a week and only meditate. And I didn't think beforehand that I actually had no meditation technique or any idea what I was doing. I just had these inspiring teachings and thought, yeah, I'll just be that. I'll just... And so when I got out 6 miles out in the middle of nowhere where there's a lot of wild animals and had a week's worth of food and thought, what do I do now? And so I just sort of sat down and trying to meditate and didn't know anything about breath meditation or what I'm actually supposed to do as a meditation object. So then just a lot of fear started coming up and it was getting dark and I didn't have a tent. I just had a sleeping bag and a sleeping mat. And I started hearing all these sounds of foxes. There was a lot of foxes around, and anybody who knows what a fox sounds like, it's quite a, if you don't know what it is, it's like a very scary kind of like bark that they do. And there was a lot of foxes around, and it's getting dark, so a lot of fear started coming up. And so that's all I was doing was meditating with fear. And then as it got dark, I just got into my sleeping bag and pulled it over my head. And it was so wild back there. There was animals running over the sleeping bag all night. I think it was mice. I think it was like mice or wood rats or something. But I just thought, I was just waiting for a big jaws to come and crunch over my head and just drag me away. So I made it to the morning. At morning time, I didn't sleep at all. And then at morning time, I packed up my stuff and walked out as quickly as I could. And so that was my foray into the yogi thing, and I called my dad and had him pick me up. And then I really knew I needed a teacher, so I started, I did a retreat with Lama Surya Das in Esalen for a weekend. It was $260. It was all my money. And it was really nice to meet him, actually. I was in a state of, I was still pretty depressed, actually. And even more depressed since I had just spent the last of my money. And but it was good. And I was in a very intense, renounced state. And Lama Surya Das, I think he sensed that. And he talked with me for a little while. And I was asking, you know, just advice. He had some good advice. So I emailed a lot of centers after that, and then Abhayagiri was one of the few places that returned my email. So I went there, visited for a week. When I visited for that first week, Ajahn Amaro was away and Ajahn Pasano was there. And one thing that impressed me and was a big factor in deciding to stay was that I had this feeling I was just some, you know, random guy coming from the world into the monastery. But then Ajahn Pasano talked with me every day and gave me all the time I wanted. All the questions were answered. And one of the things I said was, well, I don't, you know, I really feel like I should follow this path, I'm at a fork in the road. I could go back. My shoulder's healed now. I could go back to being just surfing and playing music and hang out with friends, or I could follow this path. And his advice was, don't think about it too much. And so I tried to just let it sit, and was there for a week, and decided that I would come back, because there was another guy who was going to show up and become an Anagarika, but he canceled, so there was an opening. And so I decided to just, I was working construction at the time, went, closed out my construction job, went back to Abhayagiri. I was 20 years old. This was June 2001, and went back. And then when I went back, only Ajahn Amaro was there and Ajahn Pasano was away. And the first talk I ever heard Ajahn Amaro give kind of sealed it. Was he was giving a talk about the Buddha's parinibbana, the Buddha's passing away, and one of the things he said during his talk was that all these devas and celestial beings and lay people from the countryside were all coming to pay their last respects to the Buddha. And the Buddha said to his disciples, do you see all these, you know, devas and lay people and everybody, you know, celestial music raining down flowers and everything, and paying such homage, such high homage to the Tathagata as he is about to pass away. And the Buddha then says, well, if anyone who wants to truly venerate the Tathagata, they should practice the Noble Eightfold Path. And then that really hit me really hard, and I thought, I'm in the right place. I'm committing for sure. I'm just going to stay here. So that was over 14 years ago, and that's it.
I grew up in a pretty spiritual or religious family. My family was Catholic. I went to Catholic schools growing up in Tennessee. And I got pretty disillusioned with that when I was in high school and into college, and was kind of just on a track of just being following what my dad was doing, which was construction engineering. And so I went to school for that. Didn't make it through, so kind of dropped out, similar to Ajahn Yanako, but I went east towards the big cities in the Northeast instead of going to Hawaii. But I left mid-semester, just dropped classes, and was kind of just making do in New England area, Boston area. And my brother, who was about 2.5 years older than me at the time, or he was always that much older than me at the time, he had cancer, and it was melanoma, so it was pretty obvious which direction it was going. But he was mid-20s, I was mid-20s, and he passed away in 2004 and kind of just kicked me into a tailspin. And I realized I didn't have any coping mechanisms, and the mechanisms that I was creating were not useful for coping. And luckily I had a friend who I was working with. She was much older than me, but she was going to a meditation center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she saw just from distance what was happening with me and just asked me if I would come with her one night. And so I went. And so that was, I can't remember, it was late 2004, early 2005, but it just kick-started just a downhill slope into doing anything that had to do with meditation or Buddhism. So between then and coming to Abhayagiri in 2012, I did different retreats, different study programs, practice programs, school programs, trainings, hospice, Buddhist hospice, all this stuff. And then came up to Abhayagiri in 2011 for the summer. I'd come up the first time in 2008, but just for a day, and then came back in 2010, came back for the summer in 2011. I'd actually say one of the people who really inspired me while I was there for the summer, because I spent a lot of time in the kitchen, was being around Debbie. She was very helpful. And then I remember one time, when you're there for a longer time, you start taking, like she said yesterday, you start taking on more responsibility. And I was going to learn how to do Pindapat driving, so I rode in the van with Debbie. She was driving into Ukiah with several monks. And Ajahn Yatiko was the senior monk at the time in the van. And you know, Pindapat, the drive into town, can have a different flavor. Now, since I'm a monk, I have a different perspective. Sometimes it can be business, you know, talking Debbie and the Ajahns about what needs to happen. Sometimes it can be kind of just playful and light. And then sometimes it's just very somber, like we're going on alms round, we're monks. And this occasion was very quiet, and I don't think there was anything said the whole trip into Redwood Valley and then on into Ukiah. And then we get off the freeway, or we get off 101, and they used to turn off into this little apartment, entrance to an apartment building. And Debbie pulls over, and the doors slide open, and Ajahn Yatiko, he breaks the silence. He says, "Anthony," which is my lay name. And I kind of turned around because I was sitting in the front seat. He said, "I think you should reconsider your profession." And at the time, I had no idea what my profession was. But that was very Ajahn Yatiko pointing out what didn't exist. And I was like, "What do you mean?" He was like, "You'd be a good monk." And he just got out with his bowl. And that was kind of late summer 2011, and I was in the middle of a school program, and decided I would just finish that. But that it was that was kind of just okay, you know. That was, I think, it was affirmation. It was just someone saying, "Okay, the obvious that you feel at home here, you get along with the people here, things are going well. Why go in a different direction?" He kind of just let me know it would probably work out. And so I went back to the Bay Area and kept doing what I was doing, kept practicing, but then just got in touch with the monastery about coming up the following year for a visit, and then coming for the winter retreat. And it's interesting when I was thinking about this yesterday, when I think about the different impulses I've had in my life. But it used to be I would always just I'd drop everything and run. And I would always think that I was running to something, but I was always just fleeing. And this was the first time that I knew I wanted to go somewhere, but I actually took the time to wrap things up and was able to kind of be with wrapping up my life, and in retrospect, that was a big difference for me. And so came up to Bayagiri not very long ago, just under 3 years ago, as a lay person, did the winter retreat, and this is my first year as a bhikkhu. Yeah, I still say my brother David was probably, he's probably the reason I'm here. So I owe a lot to him and his kind of just enduring what he had to go through and letting the family and the people around him watch.
Okay. Thank everybody for their sharing. But I think it's helpful, I think, for people to sort of see the, you know, what pulls us to, say, those of us who are here to make a commitment to practice, to training. I think what comes up strongly in my mind when I think of the, say, all the different choices I could have made and all the things that I had the opportunities to do but didn't, a tremendous amount of gratitude of having this path available, having you know, for myself, of course, I entered my training in Thailand, and because that's a Buddhist culture, and it's quite, say, ordinary to a certain degree. It's just part of the culture. Being able to plant the seeds of Buddhist practice and Buddhist training here in America, that's a something I feel a lot of appreciation, that there's interest. Think of all of our monastery right now, I guess. Yeah, I'm the only one who didn't ordain in America. you know, which is interesting. A lot of gratitude for the fact that this is something that is available. It's also something that people are interested in, either in plugging in and training, coming and engaging in various ways. I mean, many of the people here who are on the retreat have been associated with the monastery in various ways, so that you know, that's actually what a monastery is, in the sense of it's not just a sort of physical place that puts up its walls and locks its gates, but it's a space that people can enter into and participate in many different ways, so that the Buddha, thinking in terms of gratitude, the gratitude of the Buddha's vision of this is something that human beings can relate to and benefit from, and not just 2,500 years ago in an Indian culture, but that same template, that same archetype and model has been meaningful for human beings for over 2,500 years, and it's still relevant. It's still accessible to us, and it's a wonderful thing. And so that I think as we we continue our practice in this 10-day retreat, that's a it's a worthy reflection, because sometimes it's easy to get tied up in the nitty-gritty of, how long can I hold my breath, hold my attention on my breath, and, forget the big picture of what we're doing. That sense of, how do we nourish our spiritual aspirations? How do we practice the path, as Jnanyaniko mentioned, of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse at the end of the Buddha's life, and to pay homage and really honor the Buddha. Yeah, all we have to do is keep practicing this path of the Eightfold Path that the Buddha laid down in his very first discourse. We have the tools. Just to delight in that. So could sit quietly for a few more minutes, and then we'll have a bit of a break for walking.